House Committee on Revenue for February 20th, 2017 will come to order. And at this moment, we may change it later. My plan is to follow the agenda as printed. Oh. So we're going to start with the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants report on federal tax changes. And do you want to introduce that?
Sure.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2766 is the annual bill that updates the connection to the Internal Revenue Code. Overall, Oregon has a rolling reconnect, and that just means that the taxable income amounts for Oregon income tax are pulled from the federal taxable income. And so any changes to the federal taxable income are automatically going to change the Oregon taxable income. But there are also sections of statute that require updates every year. And so this is the section.
Okay. All right. Good. Good idea. Thank you. Go ahead, Ben.
So this would kind of pertain to that second category of connection. And so there's a number of statutes that refer to things like the public employees retirement system and also the connection to a federal code that it defines shareholders and S corporations who may represent their companies in proceedings before the tax court or the Department of Revenue. Also, there's a connection to the Internal Revenue Code that defines.
Now, are you talking about the bill now?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, before you get too far into the bill, let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2766. Now I understand what Paul's comment meant. So we're doing the information meeting and the public hearing on House Bill 2766. Please go ahead.
And so there's just a number of things that it also affects. There's some statutes governing the Oregon College Savings Plan, individual development accounts, and unemployment insurance. And so that Internal Revenue Code references simply updated to December 31st, 2016. Also specifies that if a refund is due to a taxpayer for a tax year beginning before January 1st, due to any retroactive treatment from these federal tax law connection changes, then the refund will be paid without interest, and it cancels the interest or penalties from any deficiencies caused by the reconnect. And so the background of this, there has just kind of been a rolling reconnect through most of the history of Oregon, and we are currently connected to the federal taxable income.
In some regards and not in others.
Yes, mostly
we are connected.
Yeah.
Right. Good. Thank you. Colleagues, we have before us the analysis of changes for the federal tax laws for the year 2016, and I see you have paper copies as well as the one that's on OLIS. And I would love to hear from the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. I think it's Heather and, Susanna, perhaps?
Okay.
Heather Jackson, Susanna Leidick?
Correct.
Bravo. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And would love to have your comments about the society, about your report, and about the bill.
Okay.
And if you would state your name for the record when it's your turn to talk, the minutes will accurately reflect who you are.
Okay. Sounds good. Good afternoon, Chair Representative Barnhart, Vice Chair Representative Benz, Vice Chair Representative Smith Warner, and members of the House Committee on Revenue. For the record, I'm Heather Jackson, and I'm the Chair of the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants Taxation Committee. I am a certified public accountant with the firm Durrell Conrade in Portland, Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the hearing. On behalf of over 4,500 members in the OSCPA, I respectfully testify related to the House Bill 2766. Chair Representative Bernhardt and members of the committee, this year we're bringing to your attention all the new federal legislation that happened, a whole four bills or acts. There was very little since the last time we were here last year. We are here to be a technical resource and promote taxpayer compliance by striving to keep the Oregon tax law tied to the Internal Revenue Code. As we've done in the prior years, we've broken down the acts into five parts, A through E. A is a general reconnect where Oregon is automatically reconnected. Part B is no ODR changes necessary. These provisions affect credits, penalties, and administrative rules at the IRS level. Part C is ODR changes necessary to conform to federal provisions. Part D is no ODR change necessary. These reference code but do not impact tax law. And lastly is Part E. These acts may reference the code but may not impact tax law.
Okay.
So we're going to go ahead and start with Section A, which is, again, just the general reconnect items. So starting on page one, the ones that are starred at the very front of the act name are the new ones for 2016. The other ones are ones we've reported on last year but have implications into this year. Starting with 106G, starting in January 1st of 17, reimbursements from the employer's HRA accounts are excluded from gross income only if the employee had minimal essential coverage. It's part of the Health Care Act. The Code Section 74, starting January 1 of 16, Olympians with adjusted gross income under $1 million can exclude the awards from income tax. Priorly, they were taxable. Last code section on this page, 108, home mortgage debt forgiveness ended 12/31/16, as did the mortgage insurance premium deduction on the first of the next page. It ended 12/31/16. The 7-year recovery period for motorsports entertainment complexes ended 12/31/16. The accelerated depreciation for Indian reservation properties ended on 12/16. That covered page two. Hmm. On page three.
If you have questions as we go along, please ask them. Representative Nose, did you?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Please.
Who pays the prizes for the Olympians that are getting?
I thought they got a medal.
It's made out of gold.
Good question. I don't suspect the CPAs know the answer to it either.
Sorry, no.
Okay.
Likely not Oregon.
No.
Okay.
Any other questions?
The medal is a gift that is subject to income taxes, because I guess you earned it, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So under this rule, it's no longer subject to income taxes.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. It's just the medal?
Yeah.
Right. So whatever you won.
Unless you earned more than $1 million, in which case you get to pay taxes on the medal.
Yeah.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Okay. On the top of page three, that's section 179D, energy efficient building properties, the deduction has been ended at 12/31/16. The election to expense cost of qualified mine safety equipment, qualified TV and film industry, that deduction or election ended 12/31/16. This one is kind of important. Code section 222E, qualified tuition deduction ended 12/31/16, and as of last night, it hasn't been extended or it hasn't even appeared on the table yet.
I'm sorry, which one are we talking about?
222 on the bottom of page 3. The tuition deduction.
I see. So they extended it retroactively through the end of last year.
That is correct.
But they haven't extended it further. What happened to 181F?
That one is the film industry, TV and film industry, and the expensing was ended 12/31/16.
Interesting.
Again, retroactively. We have a fair film and video industry here, so that's of interest to them, I'm sure.
Yes.
Congress has been acting that way, haven't they, lately, doing a number of these rules in retroactively rather than prospectively. I guess people assume that Congress is going to make these kinds of changes, and they would be put out if they didn't happen. All right.
That's why we're mentioning the tuition one, because that's a pretty big one.
Okay. Would you explain what the qualified tuition deduction is so that those of us who don't pay tuition lately know?
So that is for if you go to school, like college of any sort, a community college, trade school, you can deduct $4,000 of the tuition just on the front page of the federal tax return. There are income limitations, so a single person, I believe it's about $80,000, you don't get to deduct it. And for married people,
this is 2014.
Oh, it's like 160-ish.
Okay.
It's higher.
It's means tested.
It's a means tested deduction. Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
Any other questions? On page 4, code section 831, insurance companies' premiums increased from $1.2 million to $2.2 million and will be annually adjusted for inflation starting 1-1 of 17. This is just tax on their investment income. The Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015, code section 771 to 777, the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act and electing large partnership audit provisions are repealed and replaced with a single set of audit rules. Each partnership will designate a partner to bind the partners and the partnership in an audit situation. There's more in other sections of this document that go over that.
Okay, now you've included that in the section that Oregon automatically connects with. This doesn't actually have any effect on the Department of Revenue, does it?
Let me remember why.
It may be, of course, that the audits done at the federal level come to the state for its own action, and that may be why you've done that.
Yes. It's because at the federal level, they're picking somebody to designate,
right,
and you would probably follow suit with that same person to get through the audit.
I gotcha.
So audited.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We're done with Section A. Any other questions before we move on to Section B?
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Representative Bernhardt, Vice Chair Representative Bence, and members of the House Committee on Revenue. For the record, my name is Susanna Leidick. I'm a member of the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants Taxation Committee. I work with Moss Adams in Portland, Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. On behalf of over 4,500 members of the OSCPA, I respectfully testify related to House Bill 2766. Before I begin going over Section B, I can tell you who pays the Olympic Committee. It's the United States Olympic Committee is a corporation created by statute to serve as a coordinating body for the United States participation in international competitive amateur events or sports. As part of the activities of Olympics athletes participating, they receive prize money in addition to the medal that's awarded by this committee. $25,000 for gold, $15,000 for silver, and $10,000 for bronze. And before this act, both the prize money awarded to the athlete as well as the fair market value of the gold, silver, or bronze medal, or and bronze medals, were includable in gross income.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That corporation also, I assume, pays their expenses in connection with the games once they've qualified. I'm making that up, but I suspect
we're all learning this one together today.
Thank you.
My pleasure. So Section B is what I will cover with you guys today. Section B, to refresh your memory, is that there is no ORS change necessary. The provision affects a credit, a penalty, or administrative rule, which applies only to the federal tax system and does not apply to the determination of taxable income or a modification or is automatically modified by provisions in the ORS. There are two new tax acts that are in this section, and the rest are refreshers on things that are changing from last year. The law on page 5 relates to HRA, or health reimbursements arrangements, typically provided by, or in particular, provided by small employers. The Act provides that an HRA isn't treated as a group health plan, which exempts them from the excise tax levied on group health plans that don't make or don't meet the Affordable Care Act standards.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of skipped the first one, so I apologize. The premium tax credit provisions, which provides threshold, this Act provided threshold rules for determining the amount of premium tax credit a taxpayer may be eligible for when provided a small employer HRA. And then skipping down to the bottom of the page, 9831, the Act added a provision requiring small employers funding a qualified HRA to provide a written notice to each eligible employee. And the purpose of the notice was to give them the information that they needed to participate in the health insurance exchange market. Also provided some penalty provisions for not providing it. On page 6, the new Act, the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act, increased an existing penalty provision relating to failing to timely file information returns, or any type of tax return, excuse me. And all the remaining provisions over the next several pages have to deal with acts that were not extended. There's, I think, 36 different provisions that expired, 11 of which are included here over the next few pages. 25C is non-business energy property. The credit was not extended. The possession tax credit for American Samoa domestic production activities was not extended. On the next page, we have a few that relate mostly to renewable energy and fuel, as well as the Indian coal facility. So all of these provisions were not extended. If you want detail on any of them, I'd be happy to give you a little bit more. But they were all kind of looked at somewhat last year. Page 8, the Indian employment credit for wages paid to qualified Native Americans was not extended. More energy credits, this one relating to qualified investment facilities. And then starting with page 9 and continuing through page 13, we've highlighted provisions that were enacted last year and are going to into effect either this year in 2017 or 2018. I don't think we have any that are further than that in this section. It starts with limits on REITs relating to the percentage of value of interest in taxable REIT subsidiaries that they can hold. So it changes the definition a little bit for a REIT. There's a few more credits that were not extended. The empowerment zone designation period. The consistency requirement for partnership tax returns. This is post-2017, so this will come in next year. The requirement is that all items attributable to the partnership are reported or treated the same manner at the partnership level, treated in the same manner as at the individual level, so they're not able to recharacterize gains or what things. The last section is relates to the audit provisions that Heather discussed earlier, to the partnership. So the old rules were repealed and replaced with some new ones. Page 10, 6045G requires or provided for penalties applying to the information reports that a brokers are required to issue relating to securities. 6402 was a provision that allows the IRS additional time to review refund claims based on the earned income tax credit and the refundable portions of the child tax credit, object to reduce fraud and improper payments. And the last two sections relate to safe harbor provisions within penalties for failure or providing incorrect information returns.
Representative Nels, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I'm tracking this.
Sure.
Basically, because these things are on tab B, they're federal things. You're sort of updating us. But the sort of, for our purposes here, there's not really anything we're going to do about them. They just sort of roll through and happen. Am I following that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. It would be, so it's something that taxpayers or your constituents might have been accustomed to receiving a benefit in the past. That's not going to be there in the future. The idea is that
we're connected to the federal, and they made this change, so then the change just rolls into ours as well.
Yes and no, and no in that these most of these kind of happen at the federal level anyway, are only applicable to those,
okay.
But are sometimes considerations for you to take in mind, like the, if Oregon wanted to either mirror the provision or take into account when you're considering like new tax legislation, like other means or things that are impacting your constituents.
Yeah, let me comment quickly, and you tell me if I've got it right. If the federal government establishes a tax credit, that doesn't affect Oregon, because what we're tied to is the definition of income. So they figure out, you figure out what your income is on the federal side of the thing, and you pass that through to the top of the state return. And then on the federal return, you get that tax credit. It doesn't affect us because it's a tax credit on the federal side. If, on the other hand, they made a change that had to do with what that income was that you carry through to the state return, then that gets to a different section of this report.
Income would be.
Am I close?
You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
So then, just so I'm saying.
Please go ahead.
So I'm just tracking it. So then, if the feds change the definition of income, it could lower taxes or raise taxes in our state, depending on what they do.
Right. Depending upon whether their definition of income increases income or reduces income, that gets passed through to the state tax return.
Okay. And that's the reason.
But if they do something else, like establish a credit or get rid of a credit or any of those sort of things, that happens after the definition of income, then it doesn't directly affect that number that goes on the top of the state tax return.
Okay.
This stuff is complicated. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't help that in my family, I'm not the one that does the taxes. So maybe this year I should change that.
Are you sure?
No.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Page 11. The residential energy credit relating to solar was extended through 2021. This was the extension that occurred last year, but has phase outs starting in 2019. The fuel cell and other alternative forms of energy, those provisions were not extended and have since are no longer in effect. 6050H, additional mortgage interest reporting requirements. Applying to the information statements that typically banks have to distribute. In particular, they'll include the amount of outstanding principal and address of the property. 6412 extends through September 2020 the three excise taxes imposed on highway motor fuels, the retail sales taxes on heavy highway vehicles, and the manufacturer's excise tax on heavy vehicle tires. On page 12, all the tax sections in the Bipartisan Budget Act, all those references are things that we've kind of some previously discussed relating to the partnership reporting and auditing. The Trade Preferences Extension Act, 7527, requires the IRS reestablish a program for advanced payment of health care tax credit directly to health insurance providers. Page 13, 72T expands the definition of public safety officers so that they can avail themselves of the penalty relief when they make early distributions or withdrawals from a retirement plan. That is the extent of Section B.
Right.
questions before we move on to section C? Section C.
Yeah, this is the key one, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the one that the committee ought to pay special attention to.
Yes.
Okay.
Section C is ODR change necessary. The first one is Combat Injured Veterans Tax Fairness Act of 2016. This is refunds related to withholding amounts paid after 1/17 and 91. On severance payments to veterans with combat-related injuries, the three-year statute of limitations to amend the federal and state tax return, or at least the federal return, has been extended so they can go back and claim these refunds to get the withholding back. The second one is Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes Act of 2015. This is the Domestic Productions Activity Deduction, and Puerto Rico has been extended through 12/31/16. Oregon is disconnected on the DPAD. On page 15, 2016 Consolidated Apportionments Act, this is 75% of oil transportation costs can be excluded from net income for the DPAD. And those are the three that are for this year.
Would you explain what that one does? I'm not familiar with DPAD.
So Domestic Production Activities Deduction, so that is a federal deduction that Oregon has disconnected from. Basically, it's in this one, the 75% of the transportation costs are excluded from the calculation of net income when you go to calculate the deduction on the federal return. So as long as you say disconnected from federal, this doesn't apply to you.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I'm not sure I'm following this at all. So what's the practical implication of this? Does that mean who benefits and who doesn't with that? I just don't understand. What's over my head.
So the domestic production activities credit can be a lot of industries benefit from it, and this one specifically, oil refiners have gotten an extra 75% of their deductions taken away so they can have a larger number to actually calculate the tax on. So this oil refiners one, they just have a higher income so that they get to take a higher deduction.
Okay, I'm still not getting it.
No, I'm not either.
We're
obviously using terms that we don't understand, and I don't believe this issue has come before the committee during the time I've been on it. At least I don't remember it.
Brought it up last year just as a sentence.
Because
you guys are not connected to the domestic production activities deduction, just knowing that it's still out there.
What's the difference between an exclusion of costs compared to a deduction of costs? I mean, if you have a business cost, you pay for transportation, that's a business expense. That, of course, comes off before you figure in calculating net income.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between that and this exclusion? Maybe Representative Vance knows.
I'm not sure. No, I don't, Mr. Chair. But I'm just wondering how many of these oil refiners we have in Oregon. Last time I checked, we didn't have any.
I don't think there
so
are.
What
any.
You're getting to do is, you know, deductions you're taking. So you have your income in those deductions. Basically, the IRS is saying you can take 75% of those deductions and remove them to calculate this credit. They're still deductions. They still come off your taxable income. But to take and calculate this credit, you can remove 75% of your deductions, which is really weird, so that you have a higher income to take a larger credit.
So the deductions in addition to deductions that you're already entitled to. So
that's right.
So it's an additional kind of like a freebie deduction. How you determine how much of deduction that you get is based on your taxable income without regard to the deduction. So maybe what I'll do is I'll read the paragraph explanation, because sometimes the people who write these are well versed at explaining things, and in practice you get removed a little bit. A taxpayer may claim a deduction against gross income equal to 9% of its qualified production activities income. or its taxable income without regard to the deduction, whichever is less. In the case of an individual, estate, or trust, the deduction is figured without regard to, sorry, I just lost my place, adjusted gross income rather than taxable income is figured without regard to the deduction is used to calculate the deduction.
Yeah.
That didn't help. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So it's meant to incentivize
doing the oil refiners
production activities within, you know, the United States. And it's you already get to deduct all these costs, but for keeping the production at home, you get an additional amount that you're allowed to deduct off your income.
I think while you've been talking, we've been discussing among the three of us here that Oregon doesn't tax any independent oil refiners anyway, because we don't have any in Oregon, and they don't make sales here. What they sell to distributors who have sales in Oregon, and the distributors pay taxes here. Some of them do anyway. So I think we can safely go on to the next item.
Wait a minute, hold on.
No. Representative Notes.
So let's just stay in this zone, but talk about Puerto Rico for a second, because I didn't understand that one either.
Back up. Okay, back up to Puerto Rico, the page before.
So this credit or the deduction that you're getting is for United States. Well, they've added certain other countries. Puerto Rico is one of them that you can have activities there, and it still counts instead of being just the United States.
Can you give an example? I think I'm getting it.
So a company who was operating, say, in Arkansas would be entitled to the credit. Without that provision, which expires, that was related to Puerto Rico, a company that was operating in Puerto Rico would not, without that provision, be entitled to take that the DPAD deduction, which we keep referring to as incorrect credit.
Okay.
So it is a provision that gave them that additional deduction for production activities within Puerto Rico has expired, and so they're no longer receiving that benefit.
Is this a big expenditure in our state?
No.
You guys aren't tied to this.
And Oregon, actually, so it's the statutes disconnect from this particular provision, so businesses aren't able to receive this additional deduction when they file in Oregon.
So if we take no action, then we will continue to be disconnected from that 199, both 199 provisions.
That's correct.
Okay. Is that enough?
Yeah.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
On to Section D. Section D is no ODR change necessary. These reference the tax code but may not impact tax law. The only one on this one is the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015. Basically, this makes changes for lawsuits for assessment and collection of taxes and how you go about suing and such. That is the only one in Section D.
Okay.
So we're on to our last section, Section E. The acts reference tax codes but may not impact income tax law. We've included them in case they are of interest and warrant any further consideration by Oregon. There was no new acts within the section, so all of these were presented as new last year. However, these are the portions that have either expired or are going into effect this year or next year. The first is the medical device excise tax. It was suspended for 2 years in 2016 and 17. And so that will continue to be suspended or not have the excise tax imposed until the end of this year. The next two provisions relate to renewable and alternative fuels and some excise tax credits that were associated with those. Those provisions haven't been extended. Fixing American Surface Transportation Act relates to various fuel excise taxes and provides for the extension through September 30th, 2020.
Could it be 2022?
Yes.
Thank you.
I was just making sure that you were listening.
That we're awake, yes. I appreciate that. Yeah.
The next page are various excise taxes relating to fuel, tires, heavy trucks and trailers, and the highway use tax. These were extended through 2020 last year. And that brings us to the extent of the information that we came to go over with you guys this year.
Okay.
For this session. Is there anything that we can do additionally, or any questions that came to mind?
Anything else on the report or on the hearing on the bill? Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who to direct my question to.
I'll just say it, and then we'll figure that out.
I serve on this other committee that's looking at transportation needs in our state, and I'd like to get more information about the retail truck and manufacturer's tire excise tax. Is there someone who could do some homework? I don't want him sharing his opinion yet. I'm pretty sure I know what his thoughts are.
Isn't it a federal tax we're talking about?
It is, but I'm just curious if I could get additional information on that and how we could take a look
at it. You're thinking maybe we ought to do a tax like that?
I did not say that, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. I would just like more information
just making sure, Representative Smith.
About how this source of revenue is generated.
Okay.
I can look.
You're gonna have 18,000 truckers in my office next week.
Next week,
wheelers.
I think.
Your quick disclaimer should save you from at least half of those.
So that's why. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It came up this morning also in the Senate about how those different taxes may affect the market and, you know, have impacts on the transportation revenues in the state. So. Yes, I can look into that.
Awesome.
And we'll probably
thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
You.
Right, Representative Marsh?
Well, I have a non-substantive comment, which is that I just can't hold back a comment on the fact that we're asked to review a federal act called Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes of 2015. Sort of undermining any idea that we need taxes, that they support our communities, that we assess them in an equitable manner, and that is our goal. And sort of reflecting back to the quagmire that we referenced last week when we talked about the fact that we have made our tax system so complex and built in so many loopholes that essentially it is a real attraction to throw it out and start all over.
Thank you. And our only disclaimer from that particular statement is that most of the complexity was foisted on us by the feds and our decision to tie to the federal definition of income.
And there we are.
Try introducing that bill, Representative Marsh. That'll be really fun.
Anything else for these two? Representative Vance, please.
I have to speak up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I want to thank the two folks that wallow in this incredible complex area trying to protect us from high taxes for being here today, notwithstanding Representative Marsh's mean remark about high taxes. We don't want to do away with all that and have accountants wondering what they would do for a living. It would be really, really sad. So we really appreciate your being here. Thank you.
Thank you. I will say in regards to that connecting to federally may sometimes seem like it creates complications, what it actually eases. Thank you. Okay.
Right.
Compliance.
Well, again, let me add my thanks to Representative Benson. I would contradict him just a little bit based on your last comment that my experience with the Oregon Society of CPAs has been that the society's efforts, and I think your charge, in dealing with us at least, has been to do what you can to simplify the taxpayers' issues in properly reporting on their income, partly by helping us do what we can to be tied to the federal government's definition of income so that you don't have to recalculate it all. And that your clients don't have to recalculate at all. And in fact, I think the effect of that probably lowers your income rather than increases it, although I think you know that already.
Yes.
Mr. Representative Benz.
In all, Ken, this is great work.
It is.
And in the years that we've been here, we've been blessed with having you guys come in and try to sort this out for us. And I mean it. So thank you so much for your work.
Very welcome. Absolutely our pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And I will second what Representative Bench just said. We completely agree about that. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2766? I thought so. And with that, we'll close the public hearing. We'll close the information meeting and the public hearing on House Bill 2766. Paul, do we have any bill introductions today? No bill introductions. We'll skip that. Information meeting carried over from 216, business tax reform. Paul has a couple of things to add. I thought he would have a couple of things to add if we gave him the chance.
I'm sure I had the whole weekend.
You had the whole weekend to think about it, right?
And thanks for you. I did want to make a comment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, about your discussion around the QPI and the D-pad, because I think it is relevant to some of the discussion you'll have around business taxes, and also it has some relevance to your discussion around the listed jurisdictions. The QPI disconnection decision was made, and much debate in this committee, and in the Senate committee in 2005 was to disconnect from the QPI. And the QPI was the deduction, as the CPAs explained it, was really an effort to try to give an incentive for corporations to repatriate income back to domestically. And that's why you got to make this deduction. And they've talked about Puerto Rico being another possible location to do that. So it was an effort, as you've talked about, in terms of the listed jurisdictions where you have a lot of corporate income that's being reported overseas. And you see this now domestically. The current administration is discussing ways perhaps to try to do similarly what QPI was intended to do, and that's to try to repatriate some income back to the U.S. Through a favorable rate, for example. Now, if they were to go with a favorable tax rate at the U.S. Level, that wouldn't affect the Oregon base. But because they went with a deduction through the QPI, it did. And the decision was made in the legislature to disconnect from that. So that gives you a sense of kind of that same issue still out there because of the profit shifting base erosion discussion that you've had in this committee.
Okay. And I think what looking at the news magazines that Mr. Trump has suggested something else not yet defined to try to get companies to repatriate their overseas profits.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and as I say, it's very important to the state in terms of how they do that. If they do it as a lower rate, then it won't affect us directly. If they do it as a deduction, then you'd have to make that decision again as they did in 2005. It was something you wanted to connect to.
Right. Thank you.
I do have a couple of follow-up pieces of information for you the meeting on Thursday. The first one is called the Nevada Commerce Tax.
Ah.
And this was downloaded from Nevada Department of Taxation. A couple of things that to highlight here back to the discussion was notice that you have to give your taxpayer ID and legal name and so forth, and then you have to include a NAICS code category. So we talked about the differential rates. Well, that's one of the things you do. You have to sign up as a particular industry.
Okay.
The NAICS is the North American Industry Classification System.
Okay.
Used to be the, for those of you who did this kind of data years ago, it used to be the standard industrial classification or SIC codes. Now it's the NAICS codes.
Is this a government agency? Or?
Yeah, the NAICS codes are a federal agency. It actually was developed at the time when NAFTA was created, so there'd be a common industry classification. The SIC code was getting very outdated, and it was designed to replace it. So now you see all Department of Commerce data and so forth, industries are classified by NAICS. So it's something you could refer to in federal definitions. And you do have one reference, actually, in Oregon statute that I know of. So that's the thing you've got to do is define that. And then you go down and calculate all your general revenue or your gross revenue. And then you have some industry-specific deductions. And then you get down to the Nevada taxable revenue, which is line 11, less line 26. And then you apply the tax rate on line 28 on your form, and it says per NAICS code category. Okay. So you introduce you whatever you signed up above, that's what you enter for a rate. And then if you look on the second page here, there's all your choices. So they've really gone to a pretty elaborate system, surprising.
Not unlike the BMI.
Normally, you know, we tend to think of some complications growing over time as there's different pressures to look at different rates for different industries and so forth. But this is how Nevada introduced it, because this remember, has only been in place for a year. Mm-hmm. So you can see the different rates, and remember how this works. The tax rate, for example, for ag, forestry, and fishery is 0.063%, which would be 0.00063. Mm-hmm. So their rates tend to be fairly low. You can see some higher ones. Notice publishing software and data processing is 0.253%, which would be, which is basically the Ohio CAT rate, which is 0.26%. And again, what they're trying to get at is the same thing that Washington does as well, is what are those industries where you would anticipate the minimum amount of pyramiding or minimum amount of intermediate purchases, and apply a higher rate to those, and apply a lower rate to those industries where you think there's going to be a lot of intermediate purchases. So you see one of the lowest rates is for ag, forestry, fishing, and hunting, and the presumption there is that you tend to see a relatively a large amount of processing. Manufacturing also has a relatively low rate. Where you have intermediate purchases, and that where you run the risk of building those into the commerce tax in at different levels of production and creating this commerce. So that's what they're trying to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, is it also, is there a list of how they reach these justifications? For example, I was thinking you were about to say on ag, forestry, fishing, hunting, is that they have no control over their market, so there's no way to pass it on. So that they do you think that factor is taken into account as these rates are set?
Mr. Vice Chair, I think it ties more back to, and I'm basing this less on Nevada than on Washington, what I know about Washington, more on looking at models, particularly input-output models, and those that have a lot of transactions have interconnections with other sectors. Those are the ones where tend to have the greatest risk. Now, your point about market power would be a factor in terms of whether you can pass that on at the intermediate stage. But this is looking at how many chances are there to pass it along.
So this is a vertical integration issue then, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's trying to counter the incentive from a gross receipts tax and pyramiding is to attempt to vertically integrate. I mean, that's how you eliminate it, because then you don't have those transactions.
Right.
So,
Representative Knowles, and then...
Representative Bueller had a question, I think, before me.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Bonhart. So, Paul, is there an objective standard that determines what rate, or is this just a lobbyist employment act here, just as you try to move your client into the different category?
The lobbyists in the back of the room are applauding.
Yeah. I would, too.
Pretty different. Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I think it's safe to say that in Washington it's been a combination of the two. But I think in Nevada, and maybe there was some of this input in the initial phase, but as I say, this is a new tax. These rates were just established. So I would tend to think that there was some effort to try to address the issue of how many transactions are there, what makes sense to something like, for example, the software and in the Washington study, software and data processing is the sector that has the least intermediate transactions.
Shocking.
And therefore has the lowest effective tax rate for a constant rate.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in seeing their methodology for allocation of this. If there's not a clear objective methodology, I'd have concerns.
I think that's a great idea.
And certainly as we talked about last week, the obvious trade-off here is even if you do have objective methodology to do this is the complexity.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the other, you create a compliance issue up here about you've got to audit to make sure that these taxpayers have entered the right NAICS code. Mm-hmm. When there's an obvious incentive to enter some versus others.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right.
And I also, as another information piece, there's another handout in your in OLS also from the BNO.
The 4 million threshold. Mm-hmm. I just want to point that out.
Also. I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Just to point out the $4 million threshold, that is where they chose to do it.
Okay. Or Nevada.
Yes.
Yes. Madam Vice Chair, it's 4 million. Is there? They have a flat amount, and then it's applying the rate above 4 million. Remember that Ohio used a threshold of 1 million, so they've got a higher threshold. They also have, on average, lower rates than Ohio does. So, but they didn't have a corporate income tax that they eliminated, which Ohio did. So they've kind of entered this as a kind of an add-on to their existing structure. So they ended up, the revenue generation was less than what Ohio's is because of these lower rates. On the B&O classifications, you can see the main ones for the Washington.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Mouse?
Well, I'm finished. And then
okay.
Go ahead.
Right.
You might.
You can see there's three main classifications, and really there's only two, which is there's actually four listed there, but three of them are pretty much the same. The retailing, wholesale, and manufacturing mm-hmm. are a little less than 0.5%. So that's about double the CAT rate. But the service rate is three times that of the retail and wholesale and manufacturer. So again, the notion is that at the service level, you're going to see relatively small amount of pyramiding. It's primarily most of the value added is added at the service level. You're not buying a lot of expensive inputs where you could be paying the gross receipts tax, having it passed on to you. So that's the rationale. And I do have, in response to Representative Bueller's question, I do have a fair amount of information on how Washington came to these rates back in the 80s. And so I can get that for the committee. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was done by a legislative task force. Now you can see, and this is back to kind of, well, is it lobbyists or is it these technically derived? I think you see these are kind of add-ons we've seen in recent years. And the components here, these are the specialized tax classifications. And I think this is where you've seen, once those B&O rates were established in the 80s, you've seen some of these special rates come in. And that's probably due to specific cases introduced by specific industries for various reasons. And you can see that they're, you can see, for example, the aircraft ones that the chair mentioned last week, the aircraft manufacturing ones.
That's that one.
So, but again, these are the, you know, I think if you're thinking about the tiered structure,
yes.
You know, and I think it, in terms of managing compliance and simplicity, you know, you can go with a structure like here, but as soon as you get into these myriad of different classifications, then you do have the complexity is the trade-off that you'll see.
Representative Nose and then Representative Johnson.
Back to the Nevada, would the casino industry be arts, entertainment, or recreation? Is that where they would fall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, I think the casino industry is probably exempt, and the reason is because Nevada has long had a gross gaming receipts tax. Mm-hmm. Which is about 6%.
Okay.
So that's
all right.
It's relatively high.
Yep.
Yeah, but it's one of those taxes, as we've talked about in the case of some severance taxes and so forth, where there would be a fair amount of exporting going on to tourists that would be using the casinos. So, but it is a 6% gross. And remember, there's a big difference between a 6% sales tax and a 6% of gross receipts, because the gross receipts is a much wider base.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
And remind us what Oregon's prize rate is. We heard it the other day. 90
pay,
something.
Price payout, right?
Yes. 90 something.
Mr. Chair, they're two very separate prize payout rates. One is for now the lottery gets nearly all the revenue from the video poker, and that's over 90% payout. So there's a lot of churn that goes on through those machines. But the scratch-its and the traditional games, the payout rate, I believe, is 40 to 45%. So it's relatively high compared to what the gross revenue is.
Okay.
But there's so much churn in those machines that they tend to have lower, or tend to have lower payout rates.
Well, and roughly speaking, the Nevada gambling tax that you referred to and Oregon's net must be roughly similar, allowing for the fact that the gross is really different.
Yes. Well, Nevada, I know that Nevada's tax revenue, about 25% of it comes, I believe about 20% of it comes from the gross gaming receipts tax, 25% on overall selective sales taxes. One thing I would add, too, to kind of tie this back to your discussion last week around business taxes and kind of what the components are and where they come from, is to remember that 42% of business, of sales taxes are paid by business legally. They may pass some of it on, but, I mean, they're paid 42% of the sales tax states as based on the Ernst & Young estimates. So both of these states are states with sales taxes, fairly significant sales taxes in both cases, so they have a gross receipts tax on top of a sales tax. So then you really do have a bigger risk of pyramiding, because some of those industries are paying a sales tax on these business-to-business purchases plus the commerce tax or the B&O tax. But these taxes are both much broader than the retail sales tax, so they'll cover a lot more things. But in many cases, you could see a business, that same purchase could be subject to a sales tax and a gross receipts tax.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, I'm sorry, I missed Representative Johnson. Okay, please, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Paul, did you say what percentage of general fund revenue in these two states comes from this method of taxation? Nevada and
I think you told us that.
Representative Johnson, I can tell you, well, Washington, I just looked at Washington's general fund revenue, and I believe it's a little over $3 billion, and they're about twice our size. Sure. So it'd be comparable to about $1.5 billion on the Oregon economy. But I'll look that up and make sure I get precise numbers. The Nevada commerce tax was estimated to raise about $250 million. So it wasn't a huge amount. Mm-hmm. But I'll also get a precise number on that for you, so you can see those percentages.
Nevada is only 40% our size, isn't it?
Yes, population-wise, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think they have two congressmen, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else on this item, Paul?
I don't, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right.
Do I need to
carry this over till tomorrow so you can come up with some more things to tell us?
No, I think you'd give me a couple of days. But what we are working on, as I think I mentioned before, a list of a couple of things. One is information items that you have. So let me know if there are things that you'd like to know, like Representative Johnson's question, and then we can get that. And the other thing is we're kind of compiling a list of what would be kind of your decisions if you're thinking about how something like this might look. You've already talked about some of them. The rates, how would you go with something like a tiered rate structure? What kind of transition rules would you have? What kind of a threshold would you have? Those are the kind of decision points. And we're just kind of making a list so you can kind of think through what those would look like.
Representative Bueller, did you have something to add?
Yeah, just a quick question. Would it be possible to tier the rates also according to geography? The minimum wage, since we have a tiered minimum wage structure.
Let you guys pay more.
I think Representative Bueller, anyway, that the answer to that theoretically would be yes. Yeah, I think you do run into some difficulties on when you're dealing with a unitary business and where that gross receipt was derived from. But I think you could do it theoretically, yes. And you could apply rates for gross receipts derived in different areas, yes. And the other question we had last week was tiering based on size of sales, too. So that's another possibility, kind of a vertical tiering based on size as well as industry or geography.
Yeah, now, we've had tables that you've presented on corporations and size. Do you have a table on business entities, and unitary business entities and size? Not just corporations, but other entities as well.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's the big question, because you're looking at a much broader base. We are trying to put together some estimates of what those tables look like. We had a major advantage in terms of the C corps because we had the data.
Right.
We knew what the Oregon sales were, although I will point out that, you know, as we've talked about in here, when Chris went through the apportionment, Oregon sales, as we defined it for apportionment purposes, isn't always what it would be under gross receipts. And the classic example is the cost of performance and services.
Sure.
So that was an Oregon sale, but it wouldn't be counted under gross receipts tax. So we've got that differential that we get on the C-Corp returns that is not really, you know, it's not really a market-based sale. So we can make that adjustment, but we will make some, we are working on indirect ways to break that down for you so you can see what it would look like by entity.
Right.
And they were also working on some examples that the vice chairs have asked us to work on, too. So it might get you a little bit of
the
sense.
The curve is going to be similar, isn't it? There are a very small number of very large businesses and a very small businesses.
Yes. The hard data we have, again, is from Ohio. They show us how many taxpayers there are by sale. So we can look at that, and that can, of course, Ohio's not Oregon, but that can give us some sense of what that distribution looks like there. The other thing, I mean, in Ohio, you've got that 150,000 threshold. So if your sales are below 150,000, you just don't report. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have a lot of businesses that file Schedule C, for example, proprietors. They're probably just not going to file on this because they're not going to meet that filing threshold. And so you have if you look at any of these, like Secretary of State's data and so forth, you've got a whole lot of entities out there, a number of which basically have very little economic activity.
Great. Roxanne Marsh?
Yes, this is probably a basic question. Maybe you've covered it. But the numbers that you gave us last week were all a gross receipts tax predicated on the full business income from all sectors.
Yes, Representative Marsh. Well, we gave you the corporate income tax from a C corp base, and then we gave you the value added, which both the value added and one set of the gross receipts taxes had that $1 million, had $150,000 threshold and $1 million rate threshold. So that was the Ohio numbers, and then we tried to give you an idea what it would be of a $5 million threshold to $10 million. So we can tell you what we think. Going from 1 million to 5 million, how many fewer filers you would have. Mm-hmm. We can tell you that. And that's.
So is there the potential for doing a gross receipts tax that simply is about corporations and leaving the other sectors untouched? Does that make no sense?
Representative Marsh, you could. You could limit it to C corporations. Mm-hmm. If you want to make it a true gross receipts tax, though, I think that you would have to redefine gross receipts and not just use the Oregon sales definition in the corporate minimum tax, because that's what 97 was based on, what the Oregon sales definition is for corporate income tax purposes.
Mm-hmm.
That would do a couple of things for you. It would move you away from these areas where you've had inconsistency on how you're measuring Oregon sales, the cost of performance versus tangible goods. So it would move you away from that kind of a definition. The other thing it would do, and again, thinking back on Chris's tutorial on the corporate income taxes, if you go to a true gross receipts tax, and you know you're pulling it out of corporate income statutes, you get away from that public law 86272, which is the federal law limiting the nexus for corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you a broader nexus, and that's why you see both Nevada and Ohio talk about it's a privilege tax. It's for a privilege of making sales in the state. So it gets it away from that federal law, and that's been supported by the courts. So you end up taxing people that have been soliciting sales in the state, making sales in the state did not have nexus under the corporate income tax rules.
Representative Johnson?
Yeah, Paul, one of the other variables to keep in mind is whether nonprofits are in the mix or not. I think Ohio does not include them, if I'm correct, but
that's correct.
Nonprofits could involve a significant portion of your medical health care providers in a state, too. It's a pretty large segment of your economy. So, I mean, just to get everything equal out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that would be a decision, a policy decision to be made along the way.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, one thing we do have, we've looked at a little bit, is Washington has a pretty good tax expenditure report, and so they do go through and estimate the tax expenditures from exemptions from the B&O mm-hmm. tax, and you can see hospitals and some other things and how much they estimate the cost would be.
Okay. Anything else for Paul today? Paul, what have I left out? We have another 35 minutes.
Well, I think,
having exhausted our agenda yet again.
We can think of more questions for us.
We can think of more questions. This is not the last time we'll talk about this, I hope. I think that we have a lot left to go on it. And with that, I'll see you all tomorrow afternoon, 1 o'clock, and the committee is adjourned.